This is Connected to Chicago, a look at the top stories of the week with the people making, covering, and talking about the news of the day. Now, Connected to Chicago.
And welcome to Connected to Chicago. We're going to start this week with our reporter roundtable. We welcome in Lynn Sweet, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times, Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune, Heather Sharon of WTTW Chicago Tonight, and Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business.
Thanks, guys, for hopping on. Let's get right into it. Former Mayor Emanuel, grilled on Laquan McDonald during his Senate confirmation hearing to be ambassador to Japan. Lynn Sweet, you were there. What was the feeling like in the room?
Well, there is hardly anyone in the room because of COVID, and so there's no vibe to be picked up from the room. As I wrote in my column, what was remarkable is that the Republican senators didn't stick around to even toss any questions at Rahm. The two Republicans who stayed, one was there to say how much he liked Rahm and he was going to vote for him. And the other one was the co-chair of the panel. So I would say in the room, there was nothing distinct. Most interesting in the room, however, was what most of Chicago did not know, is that Rahm's son, Zach, now grown up, is a naval intelligence officer, and he came to this hearing resplendent in his dress uniform and sat behind his father. So that was just interesting bit about the Emanuel family. But the other point is most Democrats didn't show up either. Most notably, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, who is the chief champion of police reform in the Senate, and other progressive senators didn't come. So the movement by the progressives to try and block Rahm didn't go anywhere. They did have enough juice to inject it in the hearing in the form of one senator, Jeff Merkley, under pressure from progressives back in Oregon, asked Rahm questions and grilled him, but he only had 9 minutes, and he didn't know the story well enough to actually challenge Rahm when he responded to his questions. So that's kind of a summary and the lack of vibe in the room.
So does it sound like this nomination process that the former mayor is going to just kind of skate on through this?
He will advance from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I think, in about 2 weeks. The only glitch that could happen now, and it has nothing to do with Rahm Emanuel personally, is that Senator Cruz of Texas, who is on the Foreign Relations Committee, is putting a hold on a number of ambassadors. Now, a hold is not permanent. It could delay but not deny a vote. So we're waiting to see what Cruz is going to do in Emanuel. If there is no hold, the Emanuels could be on their way to Tokyo by the end of the year.
Wow. Is he qualified for this particular job, or is this kind of one of those jobs that, you know, I've had my career in politics and now this is like kind of on easy street?
Qualified to be an ambassador is sometimes in the eye of the beholder. So, and this is, you know, he's studied up. He is nothing if not prepared. But the job of ambassador to Japan is very different than a job to China, for example, where you had a consummate diplomat, Nicholas Burns, with vast diplomatic experience and multiple postings, put in a nation where we have incredible interests, military, economic. We don't have any military interests with Japan, so the portfolio is a little easier at the moment. And yet, Rahm is this, he is not without qualifications. The way you said it suggested that this is a man with no qualifications. No matter what you think of Rahm, he was a chief of staff to Barack Obama, a leader in the House, a two-term mayor of one of the biggest cities in the world. That does add a senior staffer in the Clinton White House. That is a resume.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I didn't mean it that way. I was wondering, Greg, what are your thoughts? You know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, he doesn't know Japanese. But that's just, you know, I guess that's boneheaded of me to think that way. But I don't know. Greg?
Well, I think there's two qualifications you have to have as an ambassador, particularly to a big, big, important key country like Japan. One is that whatever you report back home is going to be listened to. In other words, you're somebody who counts. And I don't think there's any doubt here that Joe Biden listens to Rahm Emanuel. The State Department's going to listen to him, and that he can kind of at the power levels of influence, he has mojo. He can communicate something. I think the other thing is you want from your ambassador, and this is where maybe Rahm is slightly more problematic. You don't want the guy to embarrass his home country, get in fights, put his foot in his mouth or anything else. Rahm does have a sharp edge to his personality. It's gotten him in trouble before, particularly when he was with Bill Clinton early in his career in the Clinton White House. But I think the mayor has learned his lesson and will probably be a good boy.
Well, let me just interject here, too. The thing that was striking to me was that the issue of Rahm getting support here came on the 7th anniversary of the shooting of Laquan McDonald, which was what drew questioning there in Congress and has been on the minds of the progressives, and gets to the point of what Lynn was making about where the progressives didn't all show up to voice concerns about this. But he did say during the hearing that, 7 years ago, a young man had had his life taken on the street in the city of Chicago. And he had, I'm quoting the story here, he had all the promise ahead of him, and a police officer took his life, killed him. And as Emanuel said, I said, then I'm the mayor and I'm responsible and accountable for the fixing. This fixing of this, so this never happens again. So it was not completely smooth. There were times that he had to be contrite, and his answer was all but putting on the fuzzy sweater that he was wearing.
You are convinced by the mea culpa, right?
He was trying to come back, right?
And there's a part of this too. This job, I would imagine, there's some schmoozing involved. Heather, the mayor's. Former mayor is good at schmoozing, right? I think so.
He sure is, and he has literally decades of relationships on that Senate Foreign Relations Committee and in the Senate himself to overcome the opposition from the progressive wing of the Senate. And I think it's important to note, as Lynn sort of alluded to, is that even if former Mayor Emanuel loses the support of progressive senators like Jeff Merkley of Oregon, who questioned him quite closely on the Laquan McDonald police murder, he is likely to make that up with the support of Republican senators, including Tennessee Senator Bill Hagerty, who introduced him at the committee meeting. So I think once the issue with Senator Cruz's hold on all of the nominations is resolved, I think it's like he's likely to be confirmed. But I was struck, like Ray was, with sort of the his 7 years later view of what happened to Laquan. And I was particularly struck to hear him say that he underestimated the depth of distrust and disbelief between the Black Chicago community and the Chicago Police Department after his death. And, of course, we're all living in a Chicago where that remains 100% true.
Another thing that we are trying to keep an eye on, and I think it's confusing to some, it confuses me sometimes, is the state maps and congressional maps. Lynn, what's the latest, as far as you know, when it comes to the congressional map?
Okay, just so our audience knows, the job of remapping the Illinois State House, the Illinois State Senate, and Congress is in the hands of the lawmakers in Springfield. So now there is a week ago we talked about a draft of a congressional map that came out that had multiple criticisms. One, it didn't strengthen the Democratic hand enough, and even though the mapmakers, the Senate president and the Speaker of the State House, did give it a partisan tilt, to yield 14 Dems and 3 Republicans. Actually, some of the Democratic districts were quite weak and could be in the right Republican year, swing district, particularly for Marie Newman and Lauren Underwood. Anyway, to get to the bottom line, a new draft is coming out. There's a possibility even of the creation of a second Hispanic district, and there will be some work done to try to add more Democratic turf for Underwood and Newman and to make some other adjustments downstate.
Greg, is I'm surprised that Democrats didn't want to take more ground, I guess. Is that surprising?
We're talking Democrats here, so they love to fight amongst themselves. You ask various people in Springfield why they rolled out of Bathacod, as Lynn correctly pointed out, so much heat from incumbent Democratic congressmen. I know of at least 3-4 different members of the delegation who publicly took shots at it. And you get different answers. One is that the congressmen were being greedy, that they weren't willing to compromise, so we had to kind of throw this out there to force them in line. Another one is there's some fights over turf between blacks and Hispanics in some cases. My kind of private theory is that for once you see the impact of Mike Manigan. Remap is never easy, particularly when you have a delayed census in the middle of a pandemic. But there was none of the people who are running the show this time had the kind of experience to know how to call a bunch of disparate people into a room and knock heads again and get it done in quite the same way that Manigan did. So some of the dirty laundry that is always there in Remap is a little more public. I agree with Lynn. I think in the end they're gonna work this out, and it's probably going to be 14-3. There's a faction that wants 15-2 Democrat, but that would create some risky districts. But I think in the end what they will do is they'll move some people from a couple districts that have an excess of Democrats into Underwood's district and into Newman's district and make it a little more Democratic, and they'll call it a day.
Just to put a little more imagery into this, this is such a hotly contested issue that back in 1981, I was watching the congressional debate or the Illinois legislature debating how to do these federal congressional maps. And what happened was a fist fight broke out on the Senate floor where a suburbanite, Mark Rhodes, was screaming at Senate President Phil Rock that he was being unfair and calling him names. And a little pint-sized former bar owner named Sam Vidalabane from Edwardsville headed over there and cold-cocked him one. So he put a haymaker on Rhodes' jaw, and that shows you what kind of emotions go into this. Now, I'm also wanting to just say here another thing that this is really all about here is that Republican legislatures throughout the country are also tilting their maps toward Republicans. So the bottom line here is some of these efforts to draw in districts that lean more Democrat in Illinois are just like the Republican efforts that are going on around the country in state houses that lean Republican. And what's at stake? What is at stake is how many of them are elected to Congress, and the question will be whether Democrats can hold on and Nancy Pelosi can hold on to the speakership.
And I know, Lynn, you've got to jump off. You've got another commitment. So we'll say goodbye and thanks for being on.
Okay, bye, everyone.
Guys, let's pivot just a little bit here. We're still talking maps, but this time Chicago's City Council Latino Caucus is...
It's Mapapalooza Week.
Mapapalooza Week, right. This new ward map. I guess, Heather, we'll go to you, and then Greg, you jump in after that.
Sure. So the map released today by the City Council Latino Caucus would create 15 wards where a majority of voters are Latino. And it does that by reducing the number of wards where there are a majority of voters who are Black by three. And this is going to run square into the really the goal of the Chicago City Council's Black Caucus to preserve Black political power in Chicago. So the way that this works, and it's really complicated, but essentially if 41 aldermen don't agree on one map, all alternative maps will go to the voters in a referendum in 2022. And that might be inevitable simply because the racial makeup of the city has changed in a way that has made it really difficult for African American politicians to protect parts of the city where they have held sway. And it has really sort of encouraged Latino Chicagoans to ensure that they're sort of exercising enough political power to be matched with their growing population. While at the same time, there are growing demands from Chicago's Asian American community that there be one ward drawn around Chinatown that will have a majority of Asian American voters. I think it's really interesting that the map today released by the Latino Caucus does not include a majority Asian American ward, and that is really going to be sort of at issue as the City Council begins to grapple with these issues once they take care of the small matter of the city's $16.7 billion 2022 budget.
Yeah, Heather makes some good points here. This is kind of the ultimate real world version of the musical chairs. Literally, somebody's going to be out, and the real clash is between the African American community, whose numbers have decreased, the population is down, but they want to keep as much political strength as they can, and the Latino community, whose numbers are going up. Now, Gil Villegas, the chairman of the head of the Latino Caucus in the City Council, and the prime author of this new map, says that they made some efforts to try to reach out beyond the Latino base. For instance, he says that Alderman Tony Beal, who's a Black alderman, signed on to this map. They have a couple co-sponsors that are up on the north side. So they went outside of their own group to try to put together a majority and work towards a majority. And that's important because ultimately, in the end, if one group wants to be really stubborn and say we won't sign on, they won't necessarily get their choice. It will, as Heather pointed out, instead just go to a referendum where heaven knows what's going to be there and what the public is going to do. So there is some interesting stuff here. Heather's also right that there is not an Asian majority ward, but there is the ward that they did carve out in the Chinatown area. It's the old 11th ward, the Daley Clan's home, is 49%. Asian. I'm not sure you can really get to 50 or much past 50. There just literally isn't the population there to do it. So this may be taken as a sufficient gesture in that direction to get support from the Asian community.
It's also clear that, you know, it depends on turnout. If you get big turnout, a bigger turnout from your Asian community on Election Day, you may be able to take the ward. So that's part of the equation that goes into that. When you say 49%, it's also how much they can bring out people in support of their candidate. So this is just one more in the, as Greg said, Mapapalooza. This is a week that we're seeing where the power lies.
Mm. And we'll have to pause here to take a quick break, but we'll be back to finish up the roundtable here on Connected to Chicago on WLS.
This is Connected to Chicago. Podcasts are available online at WLSAM.com.
And we're back to finish up the roundtable. We were talking about the mayor and the city borrowing money. Question, aren't we getting some federal COVID relief dollars? So why should we have to borrow?
Oh, we are getting. We are getting $2 billion from the feds, and that borrowing is on top of that $2 billion. So what the mayor has proposed doing is taking about 70% of that $1.9 billion, so $1.3 billion, and using that to shore up the city's budget gaps left over from 2020, 2021, 2022, and to put a little bit in reserve in case that they need it for 2023. So that leaves, you know, only a small amount to be spent on those sort of recovery programs that the mayor has endorsed and that has really been demanded by progressive aldermen and progressive groups. So to make that math work, the city has to borrow to fill that backlog. And it's really a bet by the mayor that the city's economy will improve so significantly that that added sort of borrowing won't really impact the city's overall financial stability. But, you know, like I said, that's a bet. And, you know, we've all seen this pandemic seem like it's ending only to see it regather steam. So that is really the crucial question facing the city council on this question of borrowing.
And I guess we'll end with this, that Inspector General Joe Ferguson, he's departing, right, but dropped his last quarterly report. And I guess there was a couple things in there that he didn't like or he says that the city needs to fix. Greg, I'm sure you've seen it. What has Joe Ferguson got a problem with?
Joe Ferguson has a problem with Lori Lightfoot, to put it bluntly. I had a long interview with Joe, and he kind of took off the gloves and essentially said that corruption is no better in this town than it used to be, despite his efforts. We have no checks and balances. He talked about the competencies or incompetencies, more directly, of the Lightfoot administration. Now the mayor got rid of him. Decided not to renew his term, so you have to take all this with a grain of salt. But Joe has a pretty good reputation as a straight shooter, and when he says that we haven't made much progress here, and that he's getting resistance, and that recommendations are being ignored in many cases, I have to take that pretty seriously.
And Ray, you know, I think we've talked about Joe leaving before, but definitely he's the real deal. I would think, right? I would say.
Well, he's been an independent watchdog more in the early 90s under Daley, for example, where, you know, the big issues that might have emerged from the Inspector General's office was that, you know, we were not getting paying enough attention to the rats or something like that. And I'm talking about the real rats, not the ones who run around on legislative and council floors. But one other gift that he dropped here at the end came through the Board of Ethics this week, where Jay Doherty, the former president of the City Club of Chicago, was fined $75,000 for not registering on different clients that he had when he was doing lobbying business. So he had a big series of investigations over the years, and he went out with a bang.
And we'll have to leave it there. My thanks to Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times, Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune, Heather Sharon of WTTW Chicago Tonight, and Greg Hines of Crain's Chicago Business. Up next, we have an interview. The fight between Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot and the Fraternal Order of Police over the COVID-19 vaccine mandate continues in and out of court. The next court date scheduled for Monday. Our guest this week, Professor Matthew Finken, director of the Program in Comparative Labor and Employment Law and Policy at the University of Illinois College of Law. And my thanks for joining us this week, Professor.
Happy to be here.
So I guess I want to start by asking, is this a case of the mayor essentially ignoring or dismissing the union's collective bargaining agreement with the city?
Well, if the collective bargaining agreement deals explicitly with the issue in a manner that's favorable to the union's position, if there was a clause that says they won't be subjected to a vaccine mandate, then she would be violating, city would be violating the collective bargaining agreement. But I'm not aware that that provision, such a provision exists.
So it really depends on what is in the CBA. And of course, you don't have a copy and I don't have a copy of it. This is obviously kind of new territory, I would think, because we are talking about a vaccine. It's not, a usual dispute over working conditions or something like that.
Well, I don't think that's right. I mean, employees have been required to be vaccinated. Particularly, for example, in healthcare, there are some cases, maybe a dozen or more, reported cases of employees of healthcare institutions who've objected to vaccination. And the law is pretty clear on how that plays out.
Could you tell us how that does play out?
Yeah, management has a right to require employees to be vaccinated, particularly not only for their own safety, but for the safety of their coworkers and clients, general public, the people they engage with. Now, there are pockets of exception, in particular, too, if you have a religious objection, a well-grounded religious objection, or if you yourself, if the employee suffers from a disability or a medical condition for which the vaccination would exacerbate or pose a threat of injury, in both of those cases, employers are required to engage in what's called a process of accommodation, see if they can work out something else other than the vaccination that would satisfy the employer's concern. Just 2 points on that. The standard is quite low. It's if the employer is required to do anything other than the minimum, then the accommodation process is concluded. And the second point is, if you can't achieve an accommodation, if there's none that would satisfy the employer's needs, then the employee has to either comply or be terminated.
And when talking to you earlier in setting up for the interview, you had talked about like a management rights clause. Is that essentially where the management has a right to say, hey, we got to keep everybody safe here and we got to do what we have to do to maintain safety in the workplace, kind of along those lines? Could you explain that?
Well, you're putting it back into the context of collective bargaining, and most collective agreements do have management's rights clauses. And the question of whether an employees must be accept to be vaccinated is a working condition. And ordinarily that would be subject to bargaining with a union if there is one. Management would no doubt point to its management's rights clause saying, no, we don't have to bargain about that because you've agreed in the contract that we retain certain rights and this is one of them. So there might be a dispute arising over that question. Secondly, if it's not encompassed by the management's rights clause, well, then they have to bargain about it. But bargaining is simply a process, again, of accommodation with the union's objections. And once the bargaining process has ended, if they haven't reached an agreement, then management would be privileged to take the action that it thought necessary.
And your understanding, as it applies with HIPAA really doesn't apply here, right? Because it's a vaccination status. As you said to me yesterday, it's not like this is a healthcare company releasing information, right?
Well, there's been some report in the press that I've seen, certainly on interviews with the union, that they think there's an issue of privacy involved, that the disclosure to the employer of the vaccination status of the officers is an invasion of privacy. And the answer to that is that it isn't. There are medical confidentiality laws. You mentioned the federal ones, quite complicated, this HIPAA law. But that deals with the disclosure of the medical records contained in the files of sort of what they call covered entities. That's the police department doesn't fit into that. Secondly, if an employer has the right to demand vaccination, which I think it does, it certainly has the right to demand that the employee disclose or document the employee's status. That's not a private privacy right anymore. And moreover, it's only the nature of the vaccination status is disclosed to the employee. It's not published to the general world. It's not an invasion of privacy either. I think any statutory sense, nor in our common law conception of privacy.
You had an article that you had written in Bloomberg, and I thought it was interesting. Tell us a little bit about, I guess, what are you hearing when it comes to, you know, vaccines, the mandate in the workplace, I guess kind of what we've been talking about.
Well, the statistics speak for themselves. I mean, United Airlines has demanded that everybody, all of its employees, are vaccinated. They've already are over a 90% level. Many increasingly employees, certainly in the private sector, and now the federal government has its own mandates. I mean, you know, this is a matter of not only for the safety of the employee, of the particular employee, and protecting against infection, the hospitalization, potentially death. But we're talking about the protection of the community as a whole. This goes back, you know, to George Washington, who inoculated his troops, and I believe he even inoculated his wife, which is quite dangerous at that time. We're talking 200 years ago, in front of his troops to show that it was safe. I mean, we've had mandatory requirements. Children have to be vaccinated to get into schools. We've even had quarantines of people, yellow fever, for example. I mean, this is simply, I'm just appalled at the pushback by people who say this is a matter of individual liberty. And when we live in a country that values individual liberty, but is also committed to certain communal values. I mean, I'm struck by that. I wonder whether we, you know, when I was a kid, we had a course in middle school called civics. That's what we was drilled into us. This was we certain civic responsibilities of being a citizen. It's odd to me that a police department, which is vested in the, you know, with the protective role that it has, in execution of the law, would defy the law in the way it has.
And I guess when we come back to the issue here in Chicago, safe to say it really does all come down to politics, I think, right? It's not about getting the vaccine. It's more of this political fight that we see.
Well, I'm not a resident of Chicago. It's a city I love very much. But sitting from outside the city as I listen to the rhetoric, yes, it's couched in notions of individual privilege and liberty and but it certainly does seem to be that this vaccination issue has become a flashpoint of a much larger dynamic between the police union and the mayor. It just happens to be this issue. I think it could be almost any other that they would seize on.
Sure. So yesterday, I'll explain to you, and maybe you've seen it in the news, maybe not, because you are down there, a judge basically said that when it comes to this restraining order that the union is seeking, a temporary restraining order, that it should maybe go before the labor board because the judge said that the city's argument that the president's words are essentially like a strike or could provoke a strike, really, even though there's a no-strike clause within the collective bargaining agreement, so he says maybe this should just go before a labor board. Is that maybe an appropriate place for this to move forward?
Well, if the union's claim is that this is a bargainable matter and the city has avoided or its obligation to bargain, that would be an unfair labor practice, a failure to bargain in good faith. And that would go to the labor board. It would not go to a court.
And the judge is also combining a couple of different, I guess, lawsuits into one to conserve resources, he says. That's not uncommon, is it?
No, by no means. In fact, we would want, I mean, this there is an element of public emergency about this, and you don't want, you know, different pieces of litigation floating around in different courts.
Is there anything else that you think that we missed when talking about this topic, overall?
No, I guess I'm amused is probably not the right word because the law is so very clear and the obligations of the employees of the city are so very clear, just as they are for here at the University of Illinois, for other state employees, for private sector employees. The mandate's a simple one, get vaccinated or have good reason why you should not be. I simply am befuddled as to the depth of sentiment this has triggered.
Let me just ask you, when it comes to these exemptions for, you know, a religious exemption or maybe you have a medical exemption, do companies, do they play by the rules? Would you know?
Well, yes. I mean, at least by the in the reported case, they were advised by counsel. Most lawyers try to get their major clients, you know, the major employers, to comply with the law. That's their job. They avoid litigation, you avoid the costs and the bad publicity and all of that by having the employer do the right thing. So these actions that are being rolled out by these large companies are invariably taken under the advice of counsel that they're complying with the law and they're doing the right thing. You know, let me take an easy example. If you are a construction worker, you have to wear, and you're on the job site, you have to wear a hard hat. Now, that's for your own protection. More than, you know, that's not just for the, it's not for the protection of everyone around you. But if you don't wear the hard hat, you lose your job. It's a federal rule, and it's as simple as that. If you feel that it's your liberty not to wear that headgear, that interferes with your presentation of yourself to the world or something. And I'm not scoffing at that argument. We do recognize that you have a certain liberty interest, but those are surrendered reasonably when you enter the workplace. There are health and safety rules that employees simply have to observe, and that employers might be liable if they fail to enforce.
So if you don't have if you don't want to wear the safety gear, adios. Yeah. Okay. My guest this week, Matthew Finken, director of the program in comparative law and employment law and policy at the University of Illinois College of Law. And my thanks to you for joining us again. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Up next, we'll hear from Kim Gordon. You're listening to Connected to Chicago on 890 WLS.
This is Connected to Chicago, a look at the top stories of the week with the people making, covering, and talking about the news of the day. Podcasts are available online at WLSAM.com.
The Lions are returning to the Lincoln Park Zoo this month. Joining me today to tell us about the new state-of-the-art Pepper Family Wildlife Center is Maureen Leahy, Vice President of Animal Care and Horticulture. Maureen, welcome to Connected to Chicago.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So this new wildlife center, it's been a long time in the making. You broke ground on it in 2019, so it must be something really, really special.
You know, it really is. A pandemic certainly did not slow construction on our end. We followed all safety protocols, and we have created an amazing place at the Pepper Family Wildlife Center with a state-of-the-art lion habitat and restoring the beautiful, historic, iconic lion house that was built originally in 1912.
And so this is a historic house, and you had to kind of keep that into consideration when you were, you know, making it state of the art. So what are some of the things you had to do in order to keep the history intact, but also, you know, move it to the 21st century?
No, that's a great question. And certainly by far, this was the largest and most challenging project we've had in a while at Lincoln Park Zoo. But we worked alongside with the Commission of Landmarks with the city to ensure that we maintained landmark status for this historic building because it's such an iconic part of Chicago's history and the zoo's history as well. And so we had certain zones of design flexibility that we could work with, and we were able to marry the historic building with a state-of-the-art habitat that really used data and science and our understanding of lion preferences to create a habitat that's not just expansive but very dynamic with a lot of vertical complexity, dynamic enrichment features, thermal comfort zones for the lions depending on Chicago seasons, and also a lot of shade and shelter that we knew from the data we collected on our previous Pride of Lions and understanding what their preferences were.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this week's Connected to Chicago. My thanks again to our reporters, Ray Long of the Tribune, Greg Hines of Cranes, and Heather Chiron of WTTW. Also, thanks to Matt Mellon for his technical assistance. I'm Nick Gale, 890 WLS News.
Connected to Chicago, a production of WLS News. Podcasts are available online at WLSAM.com.